Hey, everybody. Lady Luck here. And we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
In New Jersey, self-service gasoline is illegal. And I assume they will never allow a robot to pump gas at a gas station in New Jersey.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jerusalem Demsis.
I'm Matthew Iglesias.
And welcome to The Argument. Today is our first episode with a guest. Welcome, Timothy Lee of Understanding AI.
Hi there. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, Tim, you're a big fan of the show, so you heard a stray comment made, I think it was by me, several episodes ago, where I just mentioned that Matt and I had different views on AI and jobs, and you are a perfect person to come talk to us about this. So, Matt, you're the one who has kind of like a different perspective than me and Tim, so why don't you start? What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, I have the view, you know, we can never decide which one is contrarian and which one isn't, but I feel like both the founders and executives of the AI labs and normal people agree that like AI is going to be incredibly disruptive to labor markets and create large scale job losses and like wrenching social and economic transformation. And I think that they, both the people who know what they're talking about and the people who don't know what they're talking about, are correct. And I think there's this kind of like midwit economics PhD view that like, no, people always think there's going to be these disruptions and like, it's fine. And I don't think that that's right. Like, I agree that there will be some frictions, some delays, some stumbles. Nothing ever goes quite as smoothly as like the guy running a startup thinks it's going to go. But like fundamentally, on a timescale that I think is like really rapid by the standards of American politics, I think that this is going to be a huge issue, especially the next time we hit a like actual economic downturn and companies face real meaningful pressure to cut costs. I think there's going to be like a big issue here, and that the voters are right to be concerned about this. The AI lab leaders, I mean, I guess they've changed their message a little bit because they were told by their lobbyists and pollsters that this is not what voters want to hear. but I think like I don't even want to say problem, but like a big issue is going to be facing us in the, it's sooner than, you know, political people want to believe.
Well, I think, can we get more specific here? Because I also think AI is going to be a huge thing that's going to cause like massive disruptions and change how the economy works. But I think specifically area where I think me and you are different is you think that like, and maybe I'm wrong here, my perception of your views is that like AI is going to wipe out white collar jobs in like the next decade.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, look, so there's always sort of two things you have to talk about when technology and job disruption, right? There's like specific displacement where, you know, individual roles, occupational categories, whatever, either go away or they shrink dramatically in response to technological change. And then there's like the prospect of like wholesale labor displacement, right? Like there's way fewer horses today than there were 150 years ago. And that's because internal combustion engines like really, really, really eliminated the need for horse labor. It didn't, you know, not down to zero. My father-in-law works with a horse, but, you know, it's unusual. There's also a question of timelines and scales, right? So over time, we see a lot of kind of micro displacement of jobs by technology. But usually it's one category, another category. These categories are not that large. And so society as a whole does not have like a crisis that's like, oh my God, we don't have neighborhood photo development shops anymore. Like those did go away. And a lot of jobs related to analog photography went away. And that was a problem for the people in those jobs. But it wasn't like a macroeconomic phenomenon. I think at a minimum with AI, because AI is fairly general purpose, we're going to see those kind of like analog to digital photography scale displacements hitting a bunch of different sectors simultaneously, such that it's not going to be obvious what the transition is, you know, or what happens to people. It may be that like in the long, long run, it's all fine and it all reallocates. But the more you start thinking about the long run, the more you also have to think that robotics will advance to match up with things. Right now, I mean, you can't replace like anything that involves people using their hands with an AI. AI hands are just not that good. But counting on that as like the long-term salvation of human labor strikes me as like actually pretty dubious. You know, and if you go back, like when Carl Chapek was writing about robots 100 years ago, the assumption was that AI would displace manual labor first, you know, that it would be sort of like easier to fold laundry than like make charts and write code.
Yeah.
That turns out to not be the case, but like folding laundry is itself a coding problem. So, you know, like I think that like taking refuge in the limits of physical bandwidth is probably a mistake if we're saying, okay, you know, we're going to have less white collar work, but people will shift into things that are more tangible and blue collar. Like it's going to come for that as well.
Tim, what's your reaction to all this?
So I think an important thing to remember here is that when we think about a job, it's often a mix of a bunch of different tasks. And I think you're seeing this the most with programming, which is the profession that's most impacted, I think, right now by progress in AI models. We have these coding agents that can do, in some sense, can do most of what we think about as the programmer's job. Like, I know a fair number of programmers. They are telling me that their work is dramatically changing. They can give the coding agents like a big chunk of their jobs. They go off and like write this, you know, fix this bug or add this feature, and they like do most of the work. And a couple things are happening there. One is obviously is people just are producing more code. So there's features they would have not had time to produce in the past that they're producing more of. But the other thing is that it turns out that like the job of a programmer will like formally, like the main thing they're doing is writing code. There's actually a lot of other stuff they do that kind of comes around the code writing. There's a newsletter I really like called AI as a Normal Technology that recently had a post where they talked about jobs as a sandwich, white collar jobs, where first you have to decide what you're going to do, then you do it, and then you like deliver it to the customer. And so a lot of what programmers do these days is actually you know, talking to users, talking to their boss, doing testing of the software after it's produced. And increasingly, I think what you're going to see is that we'll still have programmers and the actual writing of code is going to be a smaller and smaller part of their job, but people are still going to want people involved in like deciding what the coding agent needs to do and then deciding whether it did a good job, because that inherently involves elements of politics, elements of building relationships with other people. Often it means going to a place and, you know, seeing what's happening, things like that. And I think this is likely to be true across the economy, that there are going to be some aspects of most jobs. I mean, Matt mentioned photo development. I think one reason that did lead to mass displacement is that even before the digital revolution, you had a lot of photo development shops that were integrated into Walmarts or drugstores or whatever. And so when that process got more efficient, you know, these retailers like reallocated the time of those photo developers to providing some other service at the store. And so I think for the most part, that's what I expect to happen. I think there are very few jobs that are so purely kind of automatable that we'll just get rid of them. I mean, I think there are some of those. I'm definitely not saying there's not going to be any job loss. But I think more than people expect, you're going to have jobs that are a mix of automatable tasks and not automatable tasks. And the nature of jobs will shift over time. But I think very few jobs are likely to like go away entirely.
I basically have like two like broad thoughts on this, on like this question of whether you see like wide scale white collar jobs get eliminated. First is that we see right now that AI can do a ton of tasks, like so many tasks that like I do in my job. Like it can technically write articles, whether you think they're as good as ones that I would write, that's like up to you to decide. But, you know, it can technically write articles. It can write emails. It could, you know, draft speeches. It could write my tweets. Like it can do many, many of the tasks that like make up my job. It could even like pull together performance reviews. It can write like onboarding documents for people. It could help me with financial decisions to make for the, like there's so many things about my job that could be automated with AI. But like this, there's this question of like, what is a job? And one concept I think is like super useful is this O-ring concept in within economics, which comes from the really terrible tragedy of the Challenger, where, you know, it's a spaceship that gets like, you know, that blows up as a result of like one small failure of a one piece. And Alex Imus, who's an economist in this space, has a really good analogy to cooking, where he's like, you know, you could have like a world-class chef like do everything perfectly to make this great meal, but if someone oversalts it, like the meal is inedible, right? Like it doesn't matter that you like cook the foie gras perfectly or that you got these ingredients sourced from like this perfect area. Like if you oversalt the dish, like you fucked up the whole meal. And I think this is like something really important to think about with jobs, which is like I think something that like many AI developers don't often see, is that there are tons of these jobs which get like degraded as email jobs or like middle management jobs or whatever, which have all these components within them that are the task may be automatable, but there's something specific that needs to be done that is important for humans to do. And then like secondarily, that like if one thing goes wrong, it fucks up the whole system. And so I think that like both of those arguments make it difficult for me to see like how you actually end up automating all white collar jobs.
Okay, but I think we need to, you know, look at both of these kind of examples that you guys are talking about and think about them in terms of growth and shifts in firms and elasticity of demand, right? So when productivity in a field increases, right, so that like one person can accomplish more work than they used to be able to, the impact of that on employment in that field is ambiguous, right?
Yeah.
Because if what you're doing is very, very expensive, but also very, very useful to people, the fact that one person can now achieve more means that the price goes down, means that people consume more of it, right?
Yeah.
So like, you know, the first iPhone, right, like cost a fortune and not that many people bought it. And as we got better at making smartphones, there were like more people were working and making smartphone apps. So computer programming for now, I think is proven to be a field where there is like a lot of demand for computer programming.
Yeah.
So as the AI has made it possible to automate parts of the software development stack, you've had like a labor market hiccup around that, where like temporarily a lot of companies seemed like they were pausing hiring or were like, I'm not sure what we really want to do here. And it's now picked back up as we've said, okay, what our developers are going to do is different from what they were doing 5 years ago. But like, we still have clients, we still have software that we want to ship, and we still have jobs for humans to do. So Jerusalem, like you were talking about, like AI at the argument does a lot of work, but it has not displaced anybody's like human labor because there's these O-ring tasks you need to do. But also the argument is brand new. Like the argument didn't exist 3 years ago. I think that the argument is publishing more material than the number of people on your team could have put out, in part because like you guys use AI to do things. Like,
well, to be clear, we do not use AI to write our articles.
No. Yes, but I mean, like, you used AI to like help research things that you needed to do to like get the pitch together, right? Like, I use AI to produce Slow Boring's work, not to like write the articles, but like my charts look better because I'm using AI for it. I get literature reviews from
Quad. It just like saves you tons of time on other things. Like you don't have to do your business, you know, tax forms in the same monotonous way.
Right, exactly. So small scale startups are becoming more efficient. Now in journalism, we've seen a lot of this over the past 25 years, right? And the upshot is that it's not like nobody is employed in journalism compared to how it was 25 years ago, but many fewer people are employed in the field of journalism, and yet readers have plenty of stuff to read, right? Like the internet has made the whole journalism field dramatically more productive. And there isn't the kind of elasticity response that we're seeing with computer programmers. People aren't saying, oh, any individual journalist can produce so much more than they could in the 90s, and therefore we want to read 50x the amount of stuff. We have Substacks, we have, you know, cool small magazines starting up, we have the New York Times has become an iconic global brand, but like journalism as a field is shrinking. Under pressure from technology.
Isn't this just how you define the field of journalism? Like, there's so many more creators, like people who like comment on the news, like I just think that like you're again like all things is just like a market definition problem. Like I'm not really sure you're right that like the field of journalism is shrinking if you count people who are now doing independent journalism, doing Substacks. Like you can say like that's like worse quality, but like the number of people producing content that like people classify as part of their news consumption, like seems like that has to have gone up.
Wait, no, I don't. Well, I mean, look, whatever, however the BLS quality, you know, reporters and editors and whatever, like that line is going down, right? And I mean, just to say, like, these are two different trajectories that we can see with different kinds of fields in different places. And like a famous one is when ATMs first rolled out. A lot of people were like, oh my God, there's not going to be any bank tellers anymore. And then it turned out like there were still plenty of bank tellers because the number of tellers per branch went down. But banks decided it would be good to have more branches than ever because it's cheaper to operate a branch. So in the short term, like the elasticity was saving bank teller as an occupational category, although bank tellers as a share of the population were going down during this period. Then because of mobile banking apps, we actually did get a switch. And now there's fewer bank tellers than there used to be. So, you know, the world is a little bit more complicated than you might think. It's hard to just sort of guess at first hand what is and isn't going to displace work. But just to say that, like, what Tim was saying about like jobs shifting and things recombined, like that's all true and it does happen. But like occupational categories really do shrink under technological pressure. So going back to computer programming, because I think the way this is going to go is that it's not that AI is going to replace computer programmers. It's that computer programmers being made much more productive thanks to AI are going to start being able to do dramatically more custom software for different kinds of people, for different kinds of companies, that things where, you know, it used to be, you know, you could throw a lot of resources into making like Google Docs, right? Like something very broad, very general, very useful to people. We would, you know, use these big kind of software platforms, but they're not specific enough to like meet these O-ring kind of problems. But because small groups of programmers can get so much more done with AI, you're going to start seeing, you know, whether it's IBM, other consulting firms, really working on like, how can we solve these problems for you, individual company, to get more done with fewer people? Because we've never really had that yet. And the big AI labs themselves are so focused on, let's use AI to build the next foundational model, right? Like, OpenAI and Google and Anthropic are like not trying to make line of business software right now, but their customers are going to start using it. And then the customers of those companies are going to start saying, you know what, like we need way fewer accountants than we used to because you can dump a bunch of stuff into an AI and it can do the analysis. And sure, like among other things, for legal purposes, you need like at least one human accountant in your giant company to like sign the document and say, I am accepting legal liability for this being totally fraudulent. But like, you know, that's still a lot of potential automation happening there. And unlike with, say, telephone operators or bank tellers, we're going to see this hitting a bunch of different occupational categories simultaneously. And people are going to say, like, what am I supposed to do with myself?
So I think there's a big question here about timescales, because I don't think at the most abstract level, I don't disagree with any of what Matt's saying. Like, I do think that over the next 20, 30 years, you're going to see pretty significant adjustments in the mix of what kind of jobs people have and what jobs people do within jobs, but also, yeah, like some job categories will shrink, some will grow. But if it takes 20 or 30 years, that's long enough that somebody who starts their career now can like have most of their career before, you know, the you know, that you can, most of the job losses can be through attrition or people kind of voluntarily switch to other jobs as opposed to like mass layoffs. So I think it really matters, like, is this something going to happen over 5 years or 20 years? And I think that's in partly a question about AI model capabilities. And one of the things that I think is important right now is that AI models are very good at like well-defined kind of short tasks, things that take a few minutes or in some cases a few hours, but they're really not good at longer term tasks, and they're particularly not good at maintaining context over long periods of time. I mean, a lot of what I think Jerusalem as the leader of your organization do is you have the big picture of like, here's what we're trying to accomplish. Here's how the different pieces fit together. And when a new thing happens, you know, okay, this fits into the plan or this doesn't fit into the plan. We need to like make a course correction. And right now AI is just not at all capable of that. And I think one of the big questions is that going to change? So there's a organization called Meter that made a chart that's become famous in the AI world that, about the task length. So what they do is they, this is for programming tasks, but it seems to work for other things. They estimate how long would it take a human being to do this task, and then they look at what length of task is AI, you know, able to complete with better than 50% accuracy, and that's been going up at a pretty steady rate. And so many programming tasks that take a few hours now, an AI model can do. And if that continues, you could get to a point where AI models can do jobs that take a few days or a few weeks, and you could really start to think, okay, maybe we're going to make a lot of people obsolete. The thing that's tricky, though, is that the kinds of tasks that AI models are good at are the kinds of tasks where you give the AI a really clear, like problem statement, and you have a clear way of evaluating did it do it correctly. And most short tasks are like that. You say, fix this specific bug. After you fix the bug, you can check that it was fixed correctly. But over the course of months or years, what a software engineer is doing is pretty different. It's like, optimize this website. What does that mean? Well, you have to talk to customers. You have to, you know, do economic analysis. There's like other stuff you have to do where it's actually, it's like a different category of problem. And I think that the current AI models or the current way we trade the AI models just may not do that. Like, I'm not like somebody who thinks that we're never going to figure it out, but I think there's a good chance that it's going to take another 5 or 10 years or something. It's hard to say how long, but a while before we have AI models that actually can do the kind of long context, big picture, you know, that has like a model of the world of what it's trying to accomplish, as opposed to just narrowly like doing what it's told. And I think that's one of the big questions. I'm like somewhat agnostic about how long that'll take, but I think it really matters whether it takes, you know, 5 years or 20 years.
Yeah, I definitely think the timeline question is huge here, because even Matt, I think you would say that if it took 50 years to accomplish what you're talking about, that like that would not produce the societal disruption that you're mostly concerned about.
No, absolutely. I mean, things are always changing. And gradual change
is fine, or at least can be managed better and easier. But I think there are like a couple things that make me more confident that there will be tons of frictions that make it difficult to quickly switch over. One is just like, I think people in software engineering in particular really underrate how much most people have a huge preference for interacting with humans and getting like human type labor. I mean, one of the best like classic examples that people always bring up here is about chess. So like, it's what year is it that Garry Kasparov was first beat by a computer? Sometime in the 1990s, he's beat by a computer, right?
97, I think.
97, yeah. And Deep Blue is what beats him. And chess is more popular in the following years than it ever has been. Why? Because like, just because someone can have a computer do something doesn't like take away the human preference to watch a human do something great. Like if a calculator can multiply like large numbers, I'm not like shocked by it. But like if a random person tells me they can like multiply like, you know, 7-digit numbers in their head within 30 seconds, I find that very impressive, even though like computers can already solve that task. So there's like this human preference thing, which I think is just like, we like to watch people do things because we are people and we like care about human capacity, which is why we like to watch like, you know, people run in the Olympics, even if like a car can go faster than a person. But then there's also like this relational question, right? Like, I think Starbucks is a place that tried to automate a ton of its business practice. And then its CEO like reversed this because the relational benefit was something that the customers really wanted. Like they want the barista to write the name on the cup and like maybe spell their name wrong so they can take a photo of it and send it to their friends. Like they want like a brief kind of normal human person interaction there. And then this is something that I think is like really sometimes difficult to measure and quantify, but like the existence of this preference among at least some significant part of the human population indicates that like many firms will be able to outcompete by virtue of saying like, well, this is human grade or human quality work.
Oh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
The second thing is just, you know, there's tons of things that could, like, theoretically happen as a result of technological progress. It doesn't literally happen. Like, we could have high-speed rail from San Francisco to Los Angeles, but we don't have that, in large part because there are many laws standing in the way, many practices, many legal expectations, anti-progress, localism views. And so, like, there are tons of things that make it difficult to actually implement these sorts of shifts in the real world. And on top of that, like, the protectionism, I think we're just starting to see the beginning of. Like, I just don't really think that, like, lawyers are not going to, like, force us to have, like, a certain number of lawyers, like, in a courtroom adjudicating a case. Like, I just don't think that we're going to allow there to be, like, a non-human judge, a non-human police officer involved in all of this. And to me, like, that sort of protectionism, I think we're only at the beginning of.
Well, I agree with that. But I mean, that's sort of exactly one of my concerns about this is that what we're going to do is, instead of having, like, an intelligent policy response to AI impacts on the labor market, we're going to have, like, a desperate scramble toward protectionism, right? So, like, in New Jersey, self-service gasoline is illegal. And I assume they will never allow a robot to pump gas at a gas station in New Jersey, because the point of the ban on self-service gasoline is, to make save these jobs. You know, Tim has covered in the autonomous vehicles context, there's a lot of pressure from the Teamsters unions, which is being efficacious in blue states, to ban AVs or, you know, come up with sort of safety pretexts and stuff to not allow them. So, I mean, I agree that this could be, like, a big refuge of the human labor market. But if all of economic policy turns into this kind of scramble for protectionism, like, that's bad rather than a principled way to take care of people. In terms of, like, the value of the human touch and the complexity and stuff of all this, like, I kind of think you guys are, like, overestimating the average person or what the average job is like. The largest occupational category in the BLS is office and administrative support occupations. That's 17.7 million people, and they're making a median hourly wage of a little bit less than $23. So these are not, like some of these people are, like, amazing, and it'll be very challenging to replace them. But a lot of them are, like, answering the phone at, like, the third best moving company in a small town somewhere. And they're, like, kind of checked out and disinterested and on their phone. It's annoying to deal with these people when you're a customer, things like that. And, like, we'll all look forward to replacing them with, like, a kind of mid AI. So I think, like, at the intersection of these two things, you could have, like, really elite humans, like the most charismatic and conscientious kind of people still being very valuable. And then you could have people doing sort of protectionism for themselves, and also people muddying the waters because they won't say, you know, we're not allowing self-driving trucks so that I can save my job. They'll say it's because, like, humans are needed for safety purposes. And then we'll have this kind of growing underclass where, instead of just saying, like, guys, like, the world is changing, we need to take care of people, we're going to be like, whatever the equivalent of, like, learn to code will be, except, like, not learn to code. It'll be like learn to customer service, like a 90th percentile customer service person, instead of just being like, guys, like, we have a technologically dynamic society. Like, we need to make sure that the rising tide lifts all boats.
So, I mean, I think we're talking about a slightly different set of people now. So there's the, like, purely white collar people. And I agree there's going to be some, like, people, especially in big companies, there's some people who are kind of pushing paper around, I guess, virtual paper. But, like, there'll be some, like, contraction in those kind of jobs. But so Jerusalem earlier mentioned the example of baristas, where Starbucks has tried a couple of times, actually. They did this once about a decade ago, and then once again more recently, where they sent out memos telling people to, like, be less efficient, because they said, like, don't try to make more than one cup of coffee at the same time, because people get this luxury experience from that. And I actually think there's a lot of jobs like that. I mean, I even think about it, like, as a journalist, could an AI system automate my job. One reason I think it would be difficult is that part of my job is to get sources to talk to me, experts or, you know, people out there. And in a world where there's a ton of like virtual journalists that are trying to do journalism, like sources are going to prefer to talk to a person if no other reason, because it's a signal that this is like a serious organization, that I have some confidence that an organization that like pays a human journalist, that's a signal of quality. Anytime you're in like sales, any kind of, you know, think about like restaurants, the fancier restaurants tend to have more labor. And so for the kind of mid to low end of the labor market, a lot of those jobs, it's actually like the fact that you're a human worker is a signal of the quality of the product. It might be a direct, it might be that people actually enjoy interacting with people, but it might also be that the fact that this company spent the money to have the human worker makes it seem like a more premium product. And so I think you're going to see a lot of that. You were also mentioning the like customer service person at the like second tier moving, you know,
Matt has specific beef with some main moving company that we're all
like that person is probably not just sitting at the phone, you know, sitting at the desk answering the phone. They're probably like, you know, helping out when the customer comes in. They're probably like doing some physical stuff. When there's nobody on the phone, they probably go in the back and fill out other paperwork or, you know, I don't know what what people do in third tier moving companies. But like, again, it's like, I think that it'll be relatively like some of those jobs will go away. But I think it'll take a decade or two for that to fully happen. And then many of those jobs, they'll find like other things that, where there's like a physical component of the job and they'll shift to the physical component, or there's a relational component and they'll shift to the relational component. But the other thing, like, and this is something I feel like I've learned from you, Matt, over the years, is that like really it matters whether the economy is growing rapidly, if the economy as a whole is growing rapidly. So one of the most striking findings in this last year, there was a team at Stanford that got payroll data from ADP that's like they have a very large sample size and they can really zoom in at particular occupations. And so they were looking at the software engineering industry, and software engineers in like the 22 to 25 age bracket have seen a big drop off. Not clear if this is AI related specifically or if it's more macroeconomics, but then home health age is the flip side of that. 22 to 25 year old home health aides have been growing very quickly. And I think that's like, on some level, it's a little bit of a depressing story because home health aide is like a lower status occupation than programmers. But it's also not that depressing of a story because these are people at the beginning of your career. You have a few people who wanted to be programmers who maybe don't get to. You have some people who maybe, if it's something that takes a couple of decades, and you have growing categories and shrinking categories, that's a very different story that like we just run out of things for people to do. And I don't think there's any reason to think we're going to run out of things for people to do.
And I think I'll say too, so you're referencing the Brynjolfsson, Chandar and Chen paper, The Canaries in the Coal Mine, which we'll put in show notes for people. So you saw like a 13 to 16% relative employment decline for those workers aged 22 to 25, whereas older workers in the same roles saw their jobs keep growing. And like this was interpreted as being very clearly a result of AI disruption. But then like a new set of research came out about remote work that indicated that remote work may actually be the reason that you're seeing declining hiring rates at that age group. This is the Broken Ladder, AI Remote Work and Early Career Hiring. We'll put that in the show notes too. But basically it just looks at AI exposure indexes and also the standard work from home exposure indexes and realize there's like a huge like correlation between those two. And so like, are you actually measuring that there is declining rates of hiring happening for young people in AI exposed industries or in remote work exposed industries? And like, obviously, like this doesn't actually prove which one of those is true. It just like raises the question that there's like some potentially confounding variable in the research here. But I think like the point I'm trying to make here is AI right now, its capabilities, I think, are greater than like most people, including myself. I don't know if it includes you two, believe they would be like 10 years ago. Like I'm like, sure. If you just like showed this, like what Claude could do to me like 10 years ago, I would like lose my mind. Like I don't think I could even believe it. And yet you don't see a bunch of job displacement happening in the very places where you would expect it to happen. Like even in software engineering, you don't see that. And like, in order to buy, I think, Matt's like really short timeline piece, I just think that people need to like explain to me more like why we're not seeing more disruption right now.
Okay, so I want to go back to the baristas, because this has been like an update for me. I used to write all the time about the sort of relentless growth in food service industry employment, because this was kind of like my go-to example, that there was always going to be this like reservoir of labor demand in food service. And for precisely the reason that like, it's just it's possible to run a food service business on like multiple different levels of labor intensity right now. And it's just like considered low status to have like a labor saving meal service paradigm. And like the nicer the restaurant, you do like hire a better chef and better ingredients and hopefully don't oversalt the food. But it's also just more people in a nicer restaurant, including people who aren't cooking the food like at all. And that's like part of the experience. An interesting thing that happened is that, you know, food service employment obviously fell off a cliff in March 2020, which was not technology, it was COVID. And then it rocketed back up from a certain baseline. But it has kind of flatlined since, you know, spring 2023 or so. We like kind of fully recovered to where we were pre-COVID. But then the long-standing prior trend toward ever more people working in food service has like come to an end, right? And it's grown very, very, very slowly over the past 3 years, much slower than population growth. I don't think people are 100% sure why that is, but it seems like a shift in consumer tastes toward using DoorDash more, you know, and like just like less interest in like going to restaurants and having these things come. And also, if you go, I went to Chili's recently because my whole family loves Chili's. And
what,
you know, it's like still
that's not a very on brand thing I would have expected you to say.
We love to anytime we have an opportunity to go to Chili's, we like to see it. So we were in the Bangor Chili's, and you know, it's a table service restaurant, but now, instead of like getting the check from the waiter, you're just supposed to pay on this like little device that's like sitting around at the table. Like they are trying to become a more labor saving company. And from what I could tell, like cursorily asking AI to do research for me, it's because these like low-end in-person, you know, table service restaurants are getting outcompeted by like the bowl slop restaurants and are facing pressure to like shed their kind of labor costs there. This doesn't like prove anything one way or the other about AI, but just that like these trends and tastes and consumer fads can really go both ways in different directions. And we don't know what's going to happen. And in terms of pace of change, I mean, here I agree with Tim that the critical thing is the macroeconomy, right? That American manufacturing employs dramatically fewer people than it did 30 years ago. Some of that is due to like automation. Some of it is due to compositional shift in what we make. And a lot of it is due not to like robots making stuff, but Chinese people making it instead. People have been talking about that trend like forever and ever and ever. And like worker per value add was kind of going down. But we had more people working in manufacturing than ever before. Then we had a big recession in 2001. And about 17% of manufacturing jobs went away. And that was the recession. It wasn't China. It wasn't NAFTA. But then those jobs didn't come back, right? Because as demand for those manufactured goods built back up, that demand did take place in China, in Mexico, whatever. And manufacturing employment kind of flatlined for a number of years. Then there was another bigger recession. Manufacturing fell off again. We had a little bit of a rebound, but it never came back to anything close to sort of the highest level that we're at there. So I don't think that that's a case for gradual change or long timelines. It means that, you know, like Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner, like we're going to keep going and companies are going to like not reduce their labor demand for a long, long time because they don't, or we don't know how long it'll be because they don't have to, but then something will happen, right? Like a bigger oil shock, whatever it is that throws the economy into disruption. Suddenly every middle manager in America is going to get a memo from their boss that's like, you got to lay some fucking people off. Like, tell me who you can do without. They're going to do it. Then a bunch of remaining jobs will be like transformed, as Tim was saying, by AI and things like that. But then the people won't come back, right? And we're going to have a version of the like social crisis over the decline of Midwestern manufacturing, but in much, much, much larger shares of the economy, which is just like, I don't want to be insulting to people, but just kind of like back office randos, you know, like people who are doing things that are not incredibly consumer facing, that are not incredibly high end. And it's just going to be another sort of, you know, crisis of the of the average person. Tyler Cohen is his book, Average is Over, you know, which I think like defines an important aspect of the rolling social crisis we've been living through in the 21st century, which is that it's been harder and harder to have roles where like you show up on time and you're like competent, but you're not extraordinary. And then that's seen as like a really crucial contribution to society in the way that like an assembly line job is, where like a lot of people could do that work, but it's very important that you like do it properly, right? Or the whole system breaks down. And we've been kind of, you know, having this more and more inegalitarian society. And I think that will move into white collar spaces because, you know, yeah.
But well, so I want to channel like Matt Iglesias circa 2015. So back then, yeah, we had a pretty old weak labor market. And there were all these articles and studies and stuff arguing that, well, like video games had gotten so good that young people didn't want to work anymore. And Matt was like, no, that's ridiculous. The problem is we have like a weak macro environment. Like the Fed needs to like do more quantitative easing and the Congress needs to deficit spend and we could like get the macro economy humming again. And like nobody listened to Matt and Donald Trump won the 2016 election. But then in 2021, we like did the thing and we got this huge boom. And like Matt, you were talking about how, you know, restaurants are doing labor saving devices. The reason I think the main reason they did that is in 2021, we had this big boom driven by macro policy. And there was this period where restaurants couldn't hire anybody because the workers were all like doing other things that were higher value. And I think we have like restaurants are still kind of hurting from that. It's still like the reason, I mean, it's not like unemployment's high right now. It's like a little higher than it was a year ago, but it's still like historically very low. And there's just lots of labor demand from other parts of the economy. And when that happens, jobs like restaurant workers, where the marginal restaurant worker is not adding that much value, those tend to get squeezed out and restaurants tend to automate. So I'm not sure like what that trend will be in the future, but it's exactly that kind of mechanism where if you have a lot of layoffs in other sectors, industries like restaurants will hire more people because it's like a higher status thing. But when there's a lot of demand, restaurants look for labor saving. Like that margin exists in a lot of industries across the economy. And if you're worried about like large scale job losses, the thing you need to be doing is like we need to have a hotter economy. Which right now I think it's about right. But I think that's the thing. Like there's, I don't hear anything about this story that's like special, that's different from, you know, 2012 or 2002 or, you know, 1991.
So can I ask you, what do you think about robotics?
So I'm working on a series about robotics. It'll be coming out in a month or two. And I think that's pretty far away. I think it'll be at least 10 years before you have like humanoid robots, possibly much more than 10 years before you have humanoid robots that could do a significant fraction of the like physical labor that that people do right now.
Because I do think that is the kind of more important known unknown than some of this other stuff. Because, you know, even if like if I'm right and there's like total white collar job wipeout, I mean, that would be noteworthy and people would care. But like, yes, like labor would just like most people don't have white collar jobs right now. You know, I mean, I remember during the pandemic getting really annoyed by a certain number of articles that were like, we're all working from home in our underpants now. And I was like, that's not true. Like I am. And like most of the, I was wearing pants to be clear, but you know, I guess maybe like most of the people reading Vox and the New York Times were working remotely, but like, this is like not the most people during the pandemic either like lost their jobs because, you know, they're working in restaurants or they were just doing their jobs because it's an in-person job. And, you know, we could just have way more, you know, landscapers or maids or nannies
teachers.
Or, yeah. You know, any number of different things. Unless humanoid robots come in. So, and this is where I'm like least certain, but like my vibe is that AI will be very useful at improving the pace of robotics research.
Why?
Well, because like AI is good at computer programming, AI is good at engineering type tasks that, you know, you can like get people like, you know, Apple Vision Pros and have them like record themselves folding the laundry and things like that and like generate lots and lots of training data. And so, you know, that like things, people have been obviously working on robots for like a very, very, very long time. And we use industrial robots in a bunch of contexts, but like creating like general purpose robots has proven very, very difficult.
So I actually think this, yeah, misstates like the actual problem with developing robotics and where AI is useful. Because so right now, AI is largely, we're talking about LLMs. And what you find sometimes, you have these like kind of like, you know, examples that will go viral of, you know, someone asking a chatbot like Fable or like even a very, very advanced model of one of these LLMs. Hey, like the car wash is 5 feet away. Should I drive or should I walk? And it goes, oh, you should walk. And it's like, you would only say walk to a car wash if you have like no sense of what reality is. Like, of course you want to take the car to get it washed. So you would never walk to the car wash. And there are many, many examples of this. And the fundamental underlying thing here is that LLMs actually don't have a very good understanding of what it's like to be a physical being in the world. Now, researchers are trying to solve this by trying to develop a new type of AI, which is called like a world model. And this would have tons of applicability to different sorts of problems, whether it's, you know, helping us understand biological problems, chemical problems, trying to like help resolve different medical advancements. But this is like really, at least right now, like very speculative. Like it's not clear they're going to be able to do this. And so much of what is necessary for robotics is an AI that could actually really fundamentally understand physical reality. And so I am actually skeptical that AI, I mean, I'm not saying AI, of course, will help because AI helps, I think, anyone do anything that has to do with research. But that's different than I think we're going to see like massive step changes in robotics happening.
Yeah, so there's two specific things. I agree roughly with what Jerusalem said, but two specific challenges. One is that part of the reasons that LLMs got so good so quickly is you had a whole internet of text. The way LLMs are trained is by you take an existing document and try to predict the next word in these documents. And there's trillions of tokens of text out there in the internet. There's nothing equivalent to that for physical tasks. We don't have a giant database of, you know, people sweeping a floor, right? We don't have like millions of hours of video footage or something. And there's a lot of companies working on this, but for various reasons, it's quite difficult to get. The kind of data you need is difficult and expensive to collect. And anyway, so we're pretty far from that. But the other thing, and one of my kind of hobby horses is just like comparing everything to self-driving cars. But if you go back to 10 or 12 years ago, say 2015, in some ways, self-driving cars were quite good. Google had, at that point, had for several years had cars that could drive most roads without human interventions. And a lot of people thought, you know, 2017, 2018, we're going to have these self-driving cars. Google put an order for 60,000 Chrysler minivans in 2018, expecting to like roll those out around 2020. And there isn't like any one specific reason that didn't happen. It was just there are regulatory barriers, there are manufacturing barriers. One of the big problems Waymo has now is just their cars are too expensive. And to bring down the cost, they need to do a deal with an automaker to like make a dedicated assembly line. And it takes a couple of years to set that up. There's lots and lots of those kind of frictions. And a humanoid robot we don't yet have the like prototype that can like do humanoid tasks as well as like Waymo could do 50 years ago. But we also, I think that is a more complicated product. Like we know how to make cars. That's like not a new thing. Whereas like the hands of a person are very complicated to make, like human equivalent hands are very difficult. Like balance is very difficult. So I think it's going to be another 5-ish years before we have like prototype humanoids that could do both tasks that humans could do. And then it's going to take another 10 or 15 years to scale up manufacturing, to get through the regulatory issues, to deal with the safety issues, and to do the kind of stuff that Waymo's been doing with self-driving cars for the last decade. That's going to take another 10 plus years after we have the prototypes, which we are getting very rapid progress. I mean, we have, I was in a robotics lab a couple of weeks ago to see, there's this Chinese company called Unitree that sells humanoid robots that are $13,000, which is like 1/10 of what they would have cost a decade ago. And they're quite good. You can like push them and they stay up and they like, so there is rapid progress, but it's a long road. And I think we are, you know, 10 plus years away from the point where it's actually, where you actually can like buy a robot and have it do a job that a human is doing today.
All right. Well, I will just concede to not being particularly well informed about robotics. So I will, you know, I will take your word for it that it's still safe to like learn to plumb or janitor or home health aid or whatever it is.
You know, Matt, you kind of referenced it at the very beginning of the pod, but like what is conventional wisdom here is actually a really interesting question. And like, Tim, I'm hoping you can like walk us through the landscape here a little bit. Like conventional wisdom is very different in very different arenas of this debate.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think economists tell the story that Matt was alluding to that was critiquing at the beginning about, they talk a lot about ATMs and about how, you know, bank tellers didn't go down. They talk a lot about the elasticity of demand and about the fact that jobs are a combination of tasks. So anyway, and that's, I think, the at a big picture, that's the view that I find most plausible. But then in the AI industry, I think people are more focused on the rapid improvement in capabilities. And so in Silicon Valley, there's a lot of concern about rapid job loss. And like Matt was saying, I do think there's a lot of people who think once we have sufficiently powerful AI models, that that will help a lot with robotics, which I think that is possible. I mean, one of the big questions is, to what extent can you substitute simulation for real world stuff? So right now it's with Waymo, with self-driving cars, a lot of what they do is they have like a virtual road and they have a virtual car drive around. And that's a simple enough problem for various reasons that you can get pretty good data and you can actually make a lot of progress. The physical manipulation is a much harder problem. So right now you actually have to like hire a human to go out and do the task or to like teleoperate a robot. But it might be that if with advances in AI, we get to the point where we can do that in simulation and we can have the virtual robot like sweeping the virtual floor entirely in a data center, and then you can do like millions of hours for a very low cost. And so I think it is possible. I would bet against like very rapid progress that gets us like humanoid robots within the next 10 years, but there's a lot of people in Silicon Valley who think I'm wrong about that, and I would not completely rule it out.
All right, Tim, thank you so much for joining us. This was fantastic.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. We're increasing the number of podcast, you know.
Podcast people on the argument.
It's booming. Yeah. So, you know, that's amazing. Yes, thank you.
All right. Well, we're going to be right back after this quick break.
Hey, everybody. Lady Luck here. And we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, we're back for peer review today. Got a hot off the presses research paper titled Zoning, Externalities or Misallocation. It's by Yuxin Ho, Changtai Xia, Wentai Su, Yuji Luo. Apologies to all of the Chinese speaking peoples of the world for butchering all of these names. But I'm doing my best. So this paper looks at, I sort of often get questions from people about mixed use zoning, commercial versus residential zoning. Like, do we need like YIMBYism for stores? This kind of stuff. And because I write a lot about zoning, and I think in a large set of the history of talking about zoning, it's this separation of uses has been what people are talking about, rather than the question of like residential density in the residential zones. I have always professed like agnosticism about this question. That like, I personally enjoy mixed use neighborhoods, but I don't know that there's like a important policy reason to like force people to allow a 7-Eleven in their neighborhood in the same way that there is to like allow housing in their town. What these people do is they compare how businesses are sort of spatially allocated in American cities versus in Taipei. Because Taipei, it's like mixed use zoning everywhere. And so what they're doing is they're measuring like actually like how much mixing of uses would occur without the regulatory constraint. And they find that it's a lot, right? That like the spatial, the rules in the United States are significantly binding, they think, based on this analysis, and that it has some kind of like externalities, like justification, right? That like you're removing a certain number of nuisances, but you can tell by looking at prices and actual residential demand that like mostly you are creating deadweight loss and that there is a large welfare loss, they think, from sort of single use residential zoning in American cities, and that you could make people substantially better off by forcing them to allow 7-Elevens in all residential zones. I think this will probably not be like an earth shattering conclusion to like the joint Demsis Iglesias audience. But like, I had no like analytical basis for making this claim in the past, other than like I grew up in Greenwich Village, just like Jane Jacobs. Ha ha ha.
Yeah.
Now we have like, I was complaining about her lack of real economics and math. And these guys have the economics and math to say that she's correct.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those things where like, when I think of a nice neighborhood, similarly to you, I'm like, I would like there to be like a corner store. Like I would like to be able to like walk to a coffee shop. Like I think it would be nice to be able to have like a grocery store within walking distance and a park and like whatever. And like this kind of like mixed use sense of a neighborhood is actually, I think, not what the quote unquote good life was largely depicted as, which is like single family home neighborhood. Maybe there's a park, but there's like, you would have to get in your car and drive to get to like this other place, which is this sort of you know, that has the shops, and then another place where it has schools, or like whatever it is, and another place where you go to work. And this kind of like Euclidean zoning, as you know, what's referred to as like this kind of separation of uses, is a big critique that like YIMBYs have leveled against like American zoning for a while. And like this paper indicates that there's like huge welfare gains to be made if you were to just like chill out about that. But like there's like also like a secondary kind of finding in the paper, which is that actually kind of like the Jacobsian, like Jane Jacobsian view is actually more, explains a lot more of the variation than the Euclidean one, which I found kind of confusing. So like you, the net effect of American zoning is more segregation, not less, but you still see that like somewhere between 5 to 31% of zoning decisions are trying to get towards mixing. So it's like there's this weird thing happening where like at like a baseline, there's a ton of separation that exists of the uses, but then like a bunch of like planners have kind of bought into the Jane Jacobs kind of view and are tempting on the margins to move towards more mixed use. And I think anyone looking at even, you know, new suburbs today, depending on where you are in the country, I think in Atlanta and I think in Texas, you don't see this as much. But I think when you look, it's particularly in, I mean, the Virginia suburbs, which I'm like really familiar with, but also suburbs in the Midwest, millennial tastes for suburban living are much more mixed use than like their parents' generation actually lived in. So if you go to like the Leesburg suburbs in Virginia, where you see like a huge boom of residential development, but also like a big data center boom, et cetera, just like a big growing area of the country, you see like there are these like subdivisions of homes, but then like also like there's like a main street with like five apartments, and then people will all like drive to the main street and then like walk around and like experience like some level of like mixed use development. And like I'm not sure if I think that that's like, you know, net positive, but I do think that like developers are recognizing a latent human or like millennial taste, at least, or youthful taste for more walkable environments.
I sort of an interesting counterpoint to this whole like discourse that I notice a lot here in Maine, where I am right now, is that I think everybody agrees that the like small historic downtowns of Maine cities, whether it's like Bangor or Belfast, whatever it is, where, you know, these are little towns that were built before there were cars, sometimes at a river, sometimes at a train stop, whatever, that like, those are really nice compared to like a strip mall with a giant parking lot outside of it. And there's a lot of sort of planning interest in like forcing commercial development to be in the downtowns, because the downtowns are nice and people want them to be vibrant. But then like in practice, when you're deciding where to go to like eat a meal, you know, like in the moment.
Yeah.
The fact that the place outside of town with the big parking lot, you're sure you're going to be able to park. Whereas if you drive downtown, it's like hard to say. Or you want to open a grocery store, and you could open like a little grocery store downtown and it would be adorable. And like as a tourist visiting for the weekend, you know, you'd love to walk in and browse and feel guilty and you'll buy something. But like for workaday shopping, it's just better for the supermarket to be really large. And to have a really large supermarket, it's like easier to go where the land is cheapest, and then you have a big parking lot, right? And so there's this kind of not residential sprawl, but like commerce sprawl that like is universally acknowledged to be not as nice as everything being in a cutesy downtown, but it just kind of like meets the practical, you know, demand for parking and for stores to be big and to have a lot of inventory. And I wonder, I always wonder, I mean, I hate to become like on the side of more central planning of land use, but I do wonder if there isn't a like race to the like a parking race to the bottom, where like for each business, you can sort of maximize your interests by having parking be as convenient as possible. But like when the whole town is like that, that's worse than if it's, you know, a kind of like a bustling center. And you do see, as you were saying, like in the Sun Belt, these kind of developments where there's these like Potemkin downtowns that actually don't have nearly enough people living in them to support the commerce that's there. But people kind of like to like it to exist, right? As like part of the thing. Or in San Diego, I was walking around a like apartment heavy area, and there was all these retail vacancies. And I asked a developer, I was like, what's going on? And he's like, well, by law, we have to have ground floor retail in all of these buildings. But the buildings are like 8 stories tall, so they can, you know, build them with wood. And he's like, this would have to all be like 50 story apartment buildings that there isn't demand for to like create the like ground floor mixed uses that people think they want. So I don't know.
I mean, I do think, I mean, one of the things that this speaks to is just like how much housing policy can't be extricated from like transit transportation policy. Like you could have like really amazing mixed use developments, but if they're like not conveniently located to where dense populations already exist, and it's not like easy to get there, then you have to plan for like mass parking lots. Like the reason why in like New York City, like one of the only places that's like actually like largely traversed either via foot or via transit, public transit, you can have a bunch of like these grocery stores, and it like makes a lot of sense for them to have like no parking or whatever. It's cause, like people are getting there on foot or on bike or on train or whatever it is, or on bus. And like, it's really, really difficult to just like force that from above, even with like good, I think, zoning policy, because it like requires a shift in how people are moving around the city. And like, you know, I've talked about Philadelphia on the show before. My sister lives in Philadelphia. I love Philadelphia, great city. And like one thing that's great about it is like, and this is true of like, you know, most old cities that you go to, if you're like, if they're developed pre-automobile, like Philadelphia still has like, and even in these like very residential areas, like these corner stores that are available for buying random convenience items, or there's bars, or there's coffee shop, like in like very residential parts of Philadelphia, like you still have that, and that are like walkable to most people who are buying these like, you know, row houses and townhomes. And that sort of thing is like, it's just like very, very difficult to develop a city in the way that people like to visit. I mean, there's a like classic joke, like Americans go to Europe to walk around towns and neighborhoods that they themselves have disallowed to exist in their own cities. And like, yeah, like I agree with that. And it will require like us to like do a, I mean, I agree, like there's a lot of, you have to do central planning when it comes to transportation. Like there's like no way not to have central planning when it comes to transportation. But that also implicates housing policy too, and zoning, which is like not just this question of like how many homes can you build, but like what is the form of the city that you're trying to create.
But you know, DC, where we live, is pretty Philadelphia-like in its like basic built environment, but does not have nearly as many corner stores and neighborhood bars and things like that. Like it's like DC certainly it just is a fairly dense, fairly walking, you know, walk, bike, transit, have a high mode share, but that is very committed to like corridor zoning of commerce, you know. And like you can really see like in Logan Circle, Shaw, U Street, where I live, that it's like 14th Street, 7th Street, P Street, U Street, those have stores on them, and they form like a box. And then inside the box, there's no stores. And there's the coffee bar on S and 11th, which is like grandfathered in. And everybody, it seems to me that everybody loves the random nonconforming neighborhood coffee shop. But when Harriet Tregoning, like a million years ago, she proposed—
Who is that?
She was a planning director, and then she worked for
Obama. You can't just like drop a name like that. Like anyone knows. Sorry. Who that is.
She was a DC planning director, and then she worked in the Obama administration at HUD, I think, or maybe DGS. So like she had this proposal to like legalize corner stores. And I was like, all right, like everybody's gonna love this. Like this isn't gonna be some like nightmare zoning battle. And it turned into a nightmare zoning battle. And some very small change was made. To I think just like make it easier for the grandfathered locations, you know, to stay in or like change their mode of business operation. And it really puzzled me. Like I didn't
Old people hate noise. I mean, that's the biggest problem. You know? I mean, they really hate noise. Like there's like a this great bar called. Now we're getting deep into DC living. So for our non-DCers, you have to come visit Washington. But there's this bar. It's in Shaw. It's a very like vibrant neighborhood. There's a lot of young people there. It's one of the only outdoor bars, right there. And you know, you sit outside and like at 10 p.m. they come and they like make everyone come inside because like
All Souls.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They make everyone come inside because it's like the neighbors will complain about noise. This is not like a raucous even really establishment, but I just think that noise is like the underrated problem for getting commercial ventures into residential areas. Even though people like them during the day, they just want them to be coffee shops so that they don't like bother them at night, you know?
Yeah, I mean, people need to find out, like, you can get really good white noise machines these days for your bedroom purposes. Like, there's a lot of good stuff happening in the audio space. I don't know. You know, it's, I've never, there was that article in The Atlantic about
how, like. Oh my God, don't do this to me.
About how, like, it's racist to want it to be quiet or something.
Yeah.
And as a white person who doesn't mind the noise that much. I
love when you shift between being a white person and being a Latino person.
Well, this is really maybe my Latinx roots. I mean, I don't know. I read that article and I was both like, I sort of agree with her that like people are like too worried about noise.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I agree with like the racial or class analysis of this. I think it is maybe just like, I grew up on a loud street. And so I don't know. It seems fine to
me. I will just note that there are many, many ethnicities out there, and some of them come from cultures where loudness is normal, and some of them do not. But I do not think it falls cleanly on white versus non-white lines. That's the only thing I'll say about that article.
I thought it was a rare media, just like exploring differential preferences, like just like noise aversion. Because as you say, it's like it's a really big deal in public policy. You know, like. People's preferences differ, obviously, and like that's fine. But that's what like goes back to this paper, right? Like, I think the implication of this paper is that whether it's preference for quiet or whatever it is, that people imposing that via Euclidean zoning is actually like quite large, deleterious economic impacts that are like broadly similar in scope to like anti-apartment paranoia, which was not obviously true to me versus just like I disagree. It's good to see that like not only are my preferences, but accommodating my preferences would have widespread benefits for all of humanity.
Yeah, well, we love papers
that's
confirming
the kind
our
of
priors.
Empirical research I like. You
know? Yeah, if you guys have papers out there that are confirming Matt's and my priors, send them to us and maybe we'll use them on peer review. But otherwise, Matt, this was great. I'll see you next week.
Farewell.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.